it's like a carousel, and where do you jump on? And you're never gonna learn it all on your first lesson. Sometimes I say, this is just like planting the seed. You might not understand all this now, but later you'll go, oh.
Hello, and welcome to Making School Matter, where we dive into the science of teaching and learning and how it's transforming education. As more teachers and school leaders discover the power of understanding how learners make meaning and how creating the right environment can help them thrive, the more this informs our everyday practices. On this show, I sit down with educators and school leaders who are bringing brain science to life in their schools and classrooms, using practical strategies to make learning more engaging, responsive, and making school matter for every student. Today, I'm joined by Randy Kaplan, a musician, published author, and upper school English teacher who oozes creativity and proudly owns more fedoras than I do pairs of glasses.
It's definitely close.
Yeah. Randy, thank you for being here. I'm wondering, can you start by sharing a bit about your background and what specifically brought you to Detroit Country Day School?
Sure. Well, I didn't plan on being a teacher when I was young. I was all in on being an actor at first. And I moved to Los Angeles from Michigan. From New York, I went to school in Ann Arbor for a couple of years, and I switched to UCLA. Studied English, studied acting, did some roles out there. But then I also had a band at the same time. I've been playing guitar since I was 10. I had a band in junior high, middle school, you guys call it now, I guess, out here. And I became more enamored with the music career. So then I was all in on music, touring around the country. We put on, managed to eke out an existence that way, you know, with side gigs as bartender and waiter throughout the years. Then I started editing fiction as a side hustle there too. And I was putting on plays at fringe festivals and going on tours with my band, then later solo, living in New York City. I lived in Kansas for a while. Then I met my future wife. So we decided, what else could I do? I'm editing fiction. I must have skills. So I went back to school and got a degree and thought I'd be a public school teacher, but then this is my second private school job, and I love it, and I'm blessed to have found another career that I love. So.
Yeah, there's something really special about independent schools, especially DCDS, having these opportunities. So I'll be honest with you. I've known of Randy Kaplan for many, many years. I knew you through your music before I met you in person. In 2005, when my daughter was born, we were driving around in our minivan and playing Kids Place Live on XM yeah. radio, and up comes "Don't Fill Up on Chips," and our family just fell in love with that song and listened to it for years.
Don't fill up on chips.
Why, Mom? Why, Mom?
Because if you fill up on chips, you won't. Dinner, so read my lips.
Now my daughter's in college, my son's graduating his senior year. I have a son in ninth grade, and we still sing that song to this day, right? Like, when we first got here, this is my first year at DCDS, my son, like, met you, found out who you were, realized who that was, and, like, ran down to my office and was like, "Papa, you have no idea who we're working with, Randy Kaplan." So, man, you have influenced our family through your music for many, many years. So just want you to know how much of an effect you've had on our family. From being a musician myself, too, I understand that a lot of the creativity that comes from expressing yourself through sound and storytelling and all this translates into teaching and learning, too. So yeah. I wonder, how has your musical past influenced you as an English teacher?
Well, it's interesting because my songs were always very lyric intensive. Like there were a lot of narratives and stories, story songs. And I didn't mention before, when I was a musician, I was trying to running around the country with a rock band trying to be like a folk rock star. You know, the kids' music that you were talking about came second. Like, that was by accident. You know, I had a friend whose kid was in the preschool, and they wanted me to do like a show for the kids. And I was like, I'm not singing for kids. This is ridiculous, you know? And I did it, twisted my arm and I did it and it was fun. And I thought this is really fun. And they were like, the teacher of the class said, hey, we have an opening at the school. The music guy just quit. And I was like, haha, very funny, but I'm not doing that. And I was influenced to go like do a sample show and they wanted to hire me. So I'm like, all right, I'll try that. Loved it from day one. These little kids, it was preschool. So I was the music guy, you know. I think teacher was in my title, but there was no teaching going on. I mean, I always joked that my songs are educational. See, there's a good lesson not to fill up on chips, stuff like that. But all these early songs I just wrote and put no effort into promoting, I had much more success with those than I ever did through all my efforts of self-promotion with my rock music without even trying. And I made records and I didn't even try to get them played on the radio. Someone was like, you know, they're playing your songs on Sirius XM radio, and then found out. And for years, it was a good run. I would go down to Washington, D.C., where their headquarters were, later in New York City, and have like interviews with on air like this with the different DJs there, not VJs. That was MTV.
Yeah, right.
Coming back to me. So that was, you know, I would walk, lived in Brooklyn. I would walk around and had 12 classes a week, half-hour classes, and come in and sing for the kids. So when I got into education at the high school and middle school level, I thought, oh, I already have experience. This will be great. Turns out it was the exact opposite skill set that I needed. You know, in middle school, I mean, singing for the little kids, I would basically come in and rile them up. And it was educational and creative. And the kids were amazing. They're all geniuses at that age. You know, as Wordsworth says, the child is father to the man. It's like these kids were open-minded and creative and laughing and full of joy and wonder. And it was exciting to be around them. I should probably send them royalties. They wrote half these songs, just at least influencing me to just say crazy stuff and make it up and then, you know, shape them into songs. But my natural inclination is to have fun and have people learn. And I like learning through joy also, you know. So that's a tightrope to walk, but I'm finding ways to pull it off. It's nice.
Yeah, so you've already started talking a bit about this, but I really want to dig in here. So, you know, many of us have gone through school, and it's something that has been done to us, right? There's this kind of old story of school where, you know, teaching English, it's where the teacher leads the class through text, providing its context to the students, explaining any difficult language, kind of maybe showing them where to highlight certain key passages or literary devices. Mm-hmm. The lessons are primarily lecture-based, the teacher outlining, you know, where the important passages are and guiding readers and understanding the characters, the plot development, any central ideas, things like that. And then to assess that, right, the students may complete comprehension questions or match any interpretation that the teacher wants them to have. And then you can mark that as the goal of a successful teaching an English class. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, reading like ancient texts and classical literature, but I'm curious about how you are rewriting a new story of being a reader and writer in your upper school class. I mean, you talked about, you know, doing that through joy. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly. Well, the first inkling I got that there was a different method was, you know, even before I was a teacher, I remember listening to a literary theory lecture, and the man was saying, the professor was saying, you know, before close reading, before the new critics, 100 years ago, an English lecture was basically the professor reading a text and everyone going, wow, that's amazing. You know, it wasn't even what then came what we're talking about now. Then the new critic said you could close read a text. The text is its own universe. And you look at all the structure and the sound and the sense and the content and the format and do that. And then in grad school, you know, I started learning about constructivism and how, you know, in its extreme form, you're the guide on the side or the coach. And at first, I was very resistant to that. I was like, what? This is, no, I'm going to school because I'm an expert. I have stuffed their empty vessels. I'm going to fill it. You know,
are the expert in the room, right?
Right. Yeah. So, but that, I soon was persuaded, you know, with backwards design and figuring out that you want to facilitate the epiphany. You want to facilitate the light bulb going on. You don't want to just feed them the information because that's not going to stick or work. So it's been the methods I use, yes, there's sometimes there are periods of time where you're, you know, standing in front of the room saying, you, this is what this is, just so that you have the tools and the language and the terms defined so that you can go forward. But some of the most edifying moments for me is like during these Harkness discussions where I'm not involved and I'm listening to them and feeling, wow, you know, this kid is thriving. He's discovered this thing in the text and he's talking about it with passion to his peers, and some of them are actually listening and responding to what he's saying.
Yeah, I think there's a misconception about, you know, constructivism or, you know, being the coach that that it's self-discovery, that the only way that the students are going to be successful is if they find this information on their own and have a gestalt themselves, and then we move on with everything. But there has to be direct instruction, right? There has to be some kind of groundwork that enables the learners to have those Harkness discussions. There has to be some kind of front-loading of the information in order for those kinds of experiences to be successful. And so we have to kind of, you know, kill the myth of the teacher really only stands on the side and you know, waves the cheerleading pom-poms around so that the students can do the work, right? We do have to set the groundwork and put the constraints in place for them to find that creativity and to find that way of engagement.
100% agree. In grad school, I eventually, once I bought into the constructivism, my main thing I kept saying was, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, though. You know, there's still a place for memorizing a Shakespeare soliloquy and repeating it.
Well, that brings me to the next question I have. So I did read your critical pedagogy article titled A Wood Comes Toward Dunsinane, A Synthesis of Traditional and Constructivist Methodologies. It was published in volume 32 of the Language Arts Journal of Michigan, where you wrote about the intricate balance, right, that you were just talking about of the traditional and constructivist pedagogies. When you and I talked about it earlier, kind of we leaned into the practice of laying the groundwork with the class that for the content that enables the learners to dig deeper into the literary concepts and make meaning of the text. And it piqued my interest of what you just shared, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? So can you explain a bit about, you know, and describe how that manifests in your teaching?
I mean, overall, like a general philosophy is, people just take it for granted or don't notice it, but humans, we're the only species I know of that can learn not only from the present moment, but from our ancestors and traditions and the past. Now, you inherited wisdom has value. It doesn't mean you have to listen to it all uncritically, right? You have to also go by experience and filter it through the time and the place and your own rationale. But you can't picture if we all had to just learn English all over again without any, you know, listening, or picture if we all had to learn rituals or ways to deal with something that our ancestors have figured out, great ways that work for thousands of years that might need some tweaking now. But, you know, if you're a dog, you could learn from your mother if your mother dog is alive and teaching you how to, or if you're a cat, how to clean yourself, or maybe it's instinct, I don't know. But we have this stuff in place, and in a, you know, scaling that down to a classroom, I'm not just gonna, you can't just go, here's a, I mean, you could do this reverse engineering thing a little bit, like, right, I could give, once students have a basic knowledge of what a poem is, say, or what meter is, or what rhyme is, or what, you know, what a foot of poetry is, what an iamb is, what a trochee is, then I could throw them a Shakespeare sonnet, and instead of standing in front of the room and saying, a sonnet has 14 lines, then I could go, here is what we call a sonnet. What are the traits that you notice? What are the characters?
What is that? I have a pentameter there. How are you going to figure that out?
And they don't, without even telling, they could, you know, some, it takes a while. Some are like, what is this? And then they notice, they start noticing the rhymes. What's the pattern? Well, after 20 minutes with group work, especially, they have all the list I would have instinctually 10 years ago would have just front-loaded them what a sonnet is. They have them all. Then you guide them to say, well, these are the things that, you know, here's another sonnet. Is this, you know, or I'll give them two initially. And so you have to find the common traits. That's what makes this Shakespearean or Elizabethan sonnet. So they figure it out themselves, and it sticks much more.
I also think in my previous experience as a music teacher, right, when thinking about the language of music, the students need to play with sound before they learn how sound is organized, right? You don't hold up flashcards of like quarter notes and half notes and rhythms to your newborn or toddler in their crib in order for them to learn this language, right? It's like language acquisition. Babies babble before they speak words.
Yeah.
They learn a certain word that then evokes a response from somebody. Like, oh, that makes sense to me. And then if I put words together, I form sentences and people understand what I'm saying. And then we learn the language. But after, we learn how to write it down. Mm-hmm. And so this is the way that, you know, we engage learners in new concepts is before they can even give the concept a title, they're playing with the ideas and growing that understanding as we go. Once they understand the concept, then we can say, oh,
right.
Now they know how to notice and name it and talk more in-depthly about it.
A metaphor I wind up giving a lot of, you know, teachers get annoyed, and I do too sometimes, when it's constant, why do we have to know this? Why do we have to learn this? The metaphor that works usually, there are two. One is like, hey, if the kid is a football fan, saying, why do I have to know this? I go, hey, does Jared Goff in the weight room say, this is so ridiculous, why do I have to do bicep curls? I'm not doing this on the football field. I'll never have to do this in my career. No, he knows that is an exercise to build him up so that he's better at what he eventually does. So if nothing, this sometimes convinces students, you know, once in a while. If this is an exercise, if nothing else, if you're never going to use this again, especially you don't think you're going to use this math again, it's actually, you're in the gym working out your brain so that whatever you do, you're going to be smarter.
It's like reading the texts, right? Yeah. We're going to read the texts and then we're going to dive into those, you know, literary components and figure those things out. But you have to be able to read the text. Yeah. The more you read, mm-hmm. the more you understand. But the more you understand, the better you read.
Exactly. It's like a carousel. And where do you jump on? Like you were saying before, like you have to jump on at some point. And you're never going to learn it all in your first lesson. Sometimes I'll say, this is just like planting the seed. You might not understand all this now, but later you'll go, oh. So the other, that's exactly the other metaphor is the dream cruise metaphor. You know, why can't I just read a book? Why do I have to annotate? Why do I have to answer these questions? I'm like, well, it's like if you're in an auto mechanics class, you don't just say, why can't I just drive this car down Woodward during the dream cruise? Yeah, that's great also. I also love to sit in a hammock and read a book, but if you're in the auto mechanics class, you open up the hood and you're expected to learn the names of the parts of the engine and how it all works together. You might not want to be in an auto mechanics class and just drive down Woodward, but here it's a required class, the literary auto mechanics. We have to open up the hood of the book and look into it. That being said, as we talked about, you don't just, you know, I'm sure that a successful mechanic can't just learn from reading it and learning about it. He has to go and fix and fail and try and figure out and master how to fix the engine.
So. And I'm sure you've noticed it too, that, you know, maybe some of the more reluctant readers that may not want to open the hood initially, when they do, they find value in it, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, they may not be an auto mechanic for the rest of their lives, but when they sit down into the hammock and open the book, they understand it more.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And with the different ways of teaching, some kids thrive at writing an essay or putting together sentences. And some kids that I didn't know had certain skills, like, for instance, then I do a Harkness and I notice that, wait a second, this guy who I didn't know could think like this because his writing didn't reflect it is suddenly a master, you know, interlocutor and discussing things, you know, finding, having great insights about the text. So,
you know, that's interesting you bring that up. And it reminds me of the Reggio Emilia approach and the idea of providing 100 languages, right? Kids have 100 languages. And so the writing may not be that student's language.
Yeah,
it's a requirement, but that may not be the strongest language. But when you sit down to have a Socratic conversation about it, that Harkness where you are in charge of leading this conversation, you know, as a student, that's when you find that may be the language that comes out for that student. Mm-hmm. And you learn more about not only that particular student, but their learning style, and then how that affects your planning for future lessons, knowing that, okay, well, if that really worked for the student, how might I work that more into my lesson planning?
Yeah, definitely. And you get such insight into specific students' needs. For instance, a student I thought, oh, this guy has it all figured out. All of a sudden in the Harkness, and they have to do a reflection after of what was difficult. I go, oh my, this student could not figure out how to get himself into the conversation, or this student could not figure out what to say first when she wanted to respond to someone. So you have certain speech prompts you could give them, or You know, that is a life skill they need. You can have all the answers in your head. If you can't figure out how to interject yourself into a conversation naturally, that's a skill you have to learn. You
know? Absolutely. And I think that, you know, most students have something to add, but they might not know how to.
Yeah.
And having those sentence starters or having those kind of interjection stems would really help some students, right?
Yeah.
And that's that whole idea of universal design. Like, I might not need it and you might need it, but because you use it, I might look at it and say, oh, this is one I've never thought of using before.
Yeah.
And you become, you know, somebody who thrives on that too, mm-hmm. right? So I think, you know, there's a lot of things that that we had talked about, you know, backward design of units and lesson planning, laying groundwork for future success, differentiating in the classroom, finding ways to engage all students. I think these are really great kind of pedagogical ideas. Mm-hmm. And you talked about your AP Lit class. And I know you teach some elective classes as well.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about how you created your class called Monarchs and Monsters. And can you share a bit about the themes and books you focus on?
Sure. Last year at Country Day was my first year. I taught freshman and sophomore English. The freshman class is called Literature, Speech, and Composition. So that's good. I try to have them do recitation in the Harkness and learn how to speak. And the sophomore class last year was American Literature. This year I'm teaching three sections of the freshman class and my elective, Monarchs and Monsters, for juniors and seniors. So the idea behind that class is it's... you know, I pick texts that have kings and monsters in them, whether the monsters are literal or figurative. So we started off, you know, we have some ancillary texts, short stories and poems, but the main anchor texts are the Odyssey by Homer, whoever he or she was or is or combination, whatever that is. So the Odyssey is clearly literal. There are kings and there are monsters from this world. And then the next anchor text is, we're almost done with now, Beowulf by another lesser known than whoever Homer was, an anonymous source from, it's the earliest, you know, full-length English text. In Old English, unrecognizable, sounds more like German, but we're reading a translation. We're reading a very modern translation, which I thought this would appeal to students. It's the Maria Headley translation, but it's almost too slangy for them. I think more than a few of them have said, I wish this were in like the elevated language of the epic, which is very interesting. If I do it again, I would go to, you know, the Heaney or the Burton Raphael translation. So that is, again, there are kings and literal monsters in that book too. The third anchor text is Macbeth, Shakespeare, which of course has kings. And the monsters are more parts of the personalities of the characters themselves, which when they read that, they'll find out that Beowulf and Odysseus also had monsters within them. And an interesting way of even looking at this, at the Odyssey or Beowulf, is this psychomachia kind of way where I find it helpful whenever I re-see or read a text or an opera or a film to think of all the characters as parts of my own personality. I like to have students think about that for whatever text they're reading. So how would, if this is only about Odysseus, or it's only about Penelope, or it's only about Beowulf, or whatever character, how are all the other characters just parts of their, you know, inside out type of way? That most students know that more than the psychomachia or the medieval, you know, morality plays. Inside out, all these characters inside your head from that film, these are the characters. So they will be, you know, hopefully by the end of the year, they will think of themselves as both kings and monsters and know that it's all within and without. That was my idea. And, you know, it's these are exciting texts filled with everything you could want in a text. Some people would look at the book list and scoff at it and go, well, I don't want to read the Odyssey and Beowulf and Shakespeare. But these students seem to be enjoying the text. And, you know, I always feel like these are essential texts to read at some point. You know.
Well, I think it's the way that you engage them in those texts, right? And perspective taking and looking at modern times through an ancient lens.
Yeah.
So one strategy of neuroscience is to make learning meaningful to the students in your classroom, right?
Yep.
And so some say that meaningful connections to the real world beyond the walls of the classroom, but I'd like to distinguish the idea of like real world and what's actually relevant to the students in your class. And, you know, often... what's relevant to the students in your class is different than what's relevant to the adults in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So kind of thinking about that real world and meaningful differentiation. And how do you help students make the connections between their everyday lives in the modern world and the themes in the Odyssey or Beowulf or other texts that you have? What challenges or choices might they face in their own lives?
I always consciously try to put a prompt in there about how does this relate to you? And some students say, this can never relate to me. I didn't go into a cave and fight a one-eyed monster. You know, but did you? You really haven't in your life? And then try to get them to think figuratively. You know, some of it is really modern. One thing that's springing to mind is for their Odyssey final project, there were a lot of choices. You could write something, you could make something. These three young ladies in my class decided to do a short film with featuring them as the sirens from the Odyssey. And it was really amazing. On a cold 40-degree autumn day, Saturday, they went out and spent all day swimming in the lake out here. And it's really interesting. We know the story of the sirens. The sirens are these, whatever they are, creatures. Sometimes they're depicted as mermaid-like creatures, other times as monsters. But apparently they have this irresistible singing voice.
They're like creepy mermaids.
We don't have photos. They lure sailors in there are tales where the sailors then get dashed upon the rocks and killed, or the mermaids kill themselves. It's unclear. There are many different versions of it. So, you know, Odysseus himself says, I want to be the first person to, he has such hubris and arrogance. I want to hear them. So Circe says, all right, if you want to hear the song and live, you have to tie yourself to the mast of the ship and have all your other, you know, sailors plug up their ears with beeswax or whatever, and they can't hear. And no matter how much you resist, because when you hear it, you're going to be yelling at them to untie you. So it's this crazy thing, and he succeeds at it. So these three students of mine went in they were doing the scene, but they will never forget this, you know, episode that they created, this short film, and they won't forget, you know, the scene from the center, nor will the rest of the class, you know. So each of them focused on a different episode mostly and did a project. Some of them did sculptures. Some of them did a diorama, you know, of a certain scene. But it definitely deepened their understanding of the scene, you know.
And they're creating moments.
Yes.
They're creating those lasting moments mm-hmm. that bring the curriculum to life, and like you had said, made those lasting memories.
Yeah.
That they won't forget that.
Right.
They won't forget their time in the water.
Right.
But they also won't forget that literary device in the book.
Right.
And that's, I think, what makes learning meaningful too,
yeah.
Right?
And again, in the old days when I first started learning about how to be an effective teacher, that I would have scoffed at this project giving. I would have been like, no, they all have to write essays analyzing it. But then, you know, you realize, you know, the things that you remember in life are the specific moments. And if you could associate that experience with the text, you'll have, it's like a link, a special link back to that moment. And they'll hopefully remember not only them swimming in the water and it was fun, but what it means and how it relates to the Odyssey as a text.
And let me just clarify. I mean, you do have your students write.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, they write papers in your class too.
Yes. Yes. Right?
So it's not,
right.
It's not an either or.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's definitely a yes and.
Right. Right? I could never have just projects. Sometimes, you know, I'll sneak in the paper where they do it in stages, and I'm like, look, you have a whole five paragraph essay now. But then they could do the project in addition to that, or once in a while to do a project as a choice to do a project instead of, you know, but it's definitely, you have to learn how to write and read.
Yes.
Although it's interesting, I heard, you know, I've been listening to podcasts for a long time, and one of the great podcasters, Sam Harris, pointed out that, you know, in the thousands of years ago, the oral tradition was favored over writing. Then writing became favored, and it's almost switching. It's beginning to switch back again. Like, people are much more likely to learn things from listening to a podcast than from reading the book now.
I agree. And the Gutenberg press really kind of gave way to that written language being a way of transferring, you know,
right.
information and wisdom and knowledge,
right.
Away from the spoken tradition.
Right.
And I think technology today, like yes. a podcasting studio,
right.
is shifting it back to,
right.
you know, and I think it's also like, where can you fit that in? I can't read a book and drive to work at the same time.
Right.
I can drive to work and listen to a podcast at the same time.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, things are shifting, and providing those experiences for the kids in the classroom
mm-hmm.
also gives way to those 100 languages.
Right. Right.
And also, like, where do the kids find their strengths to show the understanding of the passage of the book or, right. you know, of whatever you're asking them to create in your classroom. So really creative ways of engaging kids in the content. And I was fortunate to be a thought partner for one of your lessons for Heroes and Monsters, and looking at how a hero is created and then the journey to being an epic hero, right?
Yeah. They each had little glow-ups of their as the kids would say, Odysseus has his share of glow-ups, as they would say in the book. Athena's constantly, you know, making him more massive and handsome and younger and doing whatever she wants to his physical appearance.
Right. And so I visited your classroom. We co-taught this lesson using Magic School Generative AI mm-hmm. as a way for each learner to bring an important person from their own lives and help define characteristics of a hero and then extend that to define an epic hero. I found it very meaningful and a unique way of incorporating some emerging technology into your lesson.
Yeah.
It was an amplifier, I think, for student voice and brought in perspectives and stories from people outside of the walls of your classroom into your classroom and made it a connective piece with your students. So can you explain this lesson and how this affects students' understanding of the content?
Yeah, and the more time goes by since the lesson, I think I'm more sold on it that it had real value and meaning. It's basically an epic hero in the classic sense is someone, it's someone who's every decision has a lot of ramifications, far-flung ramifications, not just from themselves. They're usually a member of some nobility or country. Whatever they do will have far-reaching effects. And, you know, these days, especially since COVID, we've been hearing all over the place things like not every hero wears a cape or everyone's a hero, this healthcare worker's a hero, or the essential workers. So, you know, we took an everyday hero, whether it was someone from their family that they appreciated or a sports figure or an actor or a celebrity, but mostly people they knew from their world. And using AI, which also helped them hone prompts, because who knows where this technology is going. We're on like this huge, unprecedented upswing in fast development of AI. And they had to create with prompts a visual image of their hero. Then we went over the traits that a classic epic hero has, and they had to, using prompts into the AI, have the image reflect the epicness of that hero. And we had like a before and after picture in each case. I find it meaningful because they each see their person that they relate to already as a hero, and then they already made them a hero, and then adding this epic hero gave them a sense of how larger than life, you know, Odysseus or Beowulf, you know, how much larger than life each one of those is.
And it was a unique experience for each student because when you talk about Odysseus being a character, a fictional character, we can only imagine what that is, right? Yeah. But you asked the students to come up with somebody that was there, a physical being that they can think about and connect with this whole time.
Yeah.
So as they're defining this epic characteristics of a hero, they're constantly thinking about that real person and then applying that to the hero in the Odyssey. I think that's such a great way of bringing personal experience to this lesson and applying some of that like personal lived experiences of your own to an ancient text that you may not have other connections with.
Giving them almost like Arthur Miller agency, who of course took like the concept of the tragic hero who has to be like completely elevated and any mistake he makes or she makes is going to affect the country and the community. And he said, no, I can make an everyman a tragic hero. Made Willie Loman and folks like that. So this was almost like that in reverse, you know?
Yeah. How do you, with these kinds of projects in mind, design assessments that allow learners to explore character struggles or choices in a way that connects to issues that they might encounter outside of the classroom?
We're just finishing Romeo and Juliet now in ninth grade. And I find, they're all writing a four paragraph essay. You know, I spent the first half of the year so far making sure they understand how important a thesis statement is in a creative title. Now for this particular essay, it's like there's no thesis statement. Just have your title be pick an event in the play and three characters who are most responsible for that event.
Well, you have to know the rules to be able to break the rules,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. So they're going to each pick an event, you know, and they're all the major events. This one's death, that one's death, this one's suicide, this one's banishment. And they have to pick three characters that are most resonant. We've had some amazing discussions in the past few days, and I've seen their thinking expand so much where, you know, it goes from some students saying, it's all Friar Lawrence's fault, or it's all Lady Capulet's fault, to now there's not one student who would place the blame squarely and 100% on one person. They're learning the complex nature of who's responsible for what. We had some hilarious discussions yesterday that wound up citing, you could take, I had a wheel of blame that would spin around, and when the character came up, we would have a discussion of what they were responsible for in the play. You know, and some of it went back to like, I wanted them to notice this, and they did. Someone at 10 minutes into it said, this is ridiculous. Any name that lands on you could blame for Romeo's death, because it was, I'm like, yeah, the butterfly effect. And I said, you know, with my siblings growing up, all the arguments turned into, well, if you weren't born, this wouldn't have happened. That was like the ultimate one, you know.
Well, there you are connecting it to your
right,
own
exactly.
life and characters
and,
outside
and
of school,
And I said, anyone
too.
Have that? Yeah, yeah, half of them, yeah, I ever said that happens, yeah. And my mother says, don't say that, you know. And,
yeah.
It, you can go back as far as you want. Where you have to persuade me that the three characters you pick are the most responsible. And then, well, then why is there four paragraphs? The fourth paragraph, you have to come up with a couple more characters that I might say, well, why don't they make the top three? You know, and it's learning how to divvy up blame and consider whether there is, you know, how much free will goes into it, how much is deterministic. In Romeo and Juliet, supposedly it's fate, you know, and who's responsible and what else, and they're all relating it to themselves by, you know, that will be, you know, there's going to be more projects to where they think about this in terms of what they've done and what other people have done.
You know, when you started talking about the progression of students putting the blame on one person, and then as they read more and as you have Harkness discussions and as they, you know, create deeper understanding of the text, they can find blame in many different people, and kind of having that moment where it was like, okay, anybody who we name, we can put the blame on. You know, that idea connected with me in my previous experience with Cultures of Thinking and Project Zero and ways in which learners make meaning. One of those ways is uncovering complexities. And this is a beautiful example of how learners are uncovering complexities of the text mm-hmm. when they pass judgment first. And that is where their meaning is. They've made meaning of the text. And here it is. I blame Capulet. But as they start to listen to each other's perspectives and start to uncover more from the text, that complexity starts to bubble to the top. And then that is their understanding. Their understanding is that the text is complex mm-hmm. and how that text is complex, right? And that's a deep understanding. You know, when you read through a book, you know, you connect with one certain character. They're the, you know, antagonist or the protagonist or whoever you connect with. And that's who you start to embody through that book. But really to take a step out and shift your perspective lens out a bit to see everybody and think about blame in that or trust and distrust or whatever the concept is and be able to find that concept in every character and the relationships within those. That's really that's a complex way of understanding.
It is, and you have to. It's a sign of maturity to be able to hold this cognitive dissonance and not have the answer. One of my favorite things to say as a teacher is, in the rare case where I intervene in an argument, is to say, "Hey, we've already reached the apex of understanding here. You're not going to break the, you know, this wave function is not going to collapse. It's not going to be your right or your right. It's not math where you're looking for one answer. This is the discussion. This is already. It's not going to be resolved right here." So they're learning to see different ways of looking at things. You know, first they're all hating on Paris for even starting this fight with Romeo. And then I said, let's consider what Paris knows. Think that you're just going with you think he knows what you know. Let's consider the dramatic irony. And it's great to see this applied to real life. Then I'm like, could you think of a situation in your life where you assumed that this other person knew what you knew? And now you could put yourself in their shoes and understand how they acted. You know, and it usually comes down to something like, oh yeah, the guy in the highway who cut me off. Maybe he was rushing to the hospital. You know,
it's perspective taking. Yes, right. You know, you are beautifully describing constructivism as you start describing how you guide students in thinking differently. Right. You're posing a question. You're saying, hey, have you considered? And then let the discussion unfold. Right. Where you could have said, hey, wait a minute.
Right.
This is not how it goes. You're thinking this way, but this is the way that we should be thinking because this is the way the story's going. Right. And it's
right.
The art of questioning. And I think that you're really demonstrating how that is pervasive in your teaching and how then the students are making meaning from uncovering those complexities, reading more of the book and understanding the characters more. And you are there as a as the lead teacher, but also that guide to say, hey, I know we need to be thinking about these things, but what type of question can I ask that will help learners shift that thinking in a way that they're the ones in the driver's seat, right? So if I can ask, I mean, this is, you know, a little off script, but what questions have you found to be most impactful or most meaningful in your classroom or in your teaching?
What questions that I would
that
ask?
That you ask during, like in a lesson, what questions do you find are your go-to guiding questions? Like I'll share one of mine is what makes you say that?
Right.
Or
right.
What makes you think that? Right. That asks students to stop.
Right.
And then how am I going to back up my answer? Right.
We have like, you know, all the speech prompts that we, you know, like where do you find evidence for that in the text, all that. I love, is there another way of thinking of that? You know, because it's like if you're writing a persuasive essay, you don't just write one side. You have to already know in advance what the best argument on the other side is. So, you know, it's like if you assign someone a debate and then switch their roles. So you should be able to argue something that you don't believe in just for the skill of, you know, I don't want to turn into sophists or anything, but like you want to always be able to consider another point of view. You might dismiss it eventually, but you have to at least entertain it and consider it. You know,
and that, so I think that also grows the idea of divergent thinking because you form an opinion, you form an answer. And when you ask what's another way of thinking about that,
right,
it prompts like, oh, there's probably another way of thinking about that.
Yes.
And what might that be?
Yeah.
And those are dispositions we want to also foster in the children in our classroom, right? Like, we want to have them think about other people's perspectives, form your own and have your own, but also be mindful that there might be, you know, alternative ways of thinking.
And I want to take away the stigma of someone changing their mind. It's a good thing. Like, have you ever changed your mind about something? People, like, they think that you have to, like, pick a thing early in your life and just stay with that. Changing your mind is not a sign of waffling or being weak-willed. It's someone that considers evidence all the time and is willing to go where the truth is or where they could find the truth and the best support for their, you know, it's nothing more frustrating. We pointed out in public life, you see people are just locked into their position and they're not having an honest debate. They're waiting for the other person to stop talking so they could say what they want to say. You know, so to actually show, you know, or facilitate kids figuring out how to have a real change. And I, you know, my favorite moment as a teacher is when I learn something. I take it from like, the studying with like rabbis or the Jewish way of thinking is chavruta. You have a partner pair that works together. And then also in that context, the teacher doesn't call himself, it's like, let's do some learning together. I'll use that phraseology and someone will say, what do you mean learning? Like I'll say to a student, it's been great learning with you this semester because I learn also. Yes. I love getting stumped when someone asks me something, but I love saying, I don't know. Let's look into this, or you should look into that and tell me about it.
Yeah, it's the idea of language matters a lot in the classroom, and the shift from I and me to us and we.
Yeah.
You're a co-learner in the classroom. Yes, you are the lead learner, and you're guiding. You're disseminating information. Please don't get me wrong. Yeah. But the idea of that everybody plays a role in the learning in the classroom, right? They're not waiting for you.
Right.
All of us are active participants in the learning, right? And, you know, one thing you mentioned before that that really struck me, too, is the idea of changing your mind. That's a sophisticated way of thinking, right?
Yeah.
And I often use a thinking routine called I used to think and now I think, right? Yeah. And that asks you, what was your thought before and what is your thought now? More importantly is a part in the middle that I've added, right? So you have I used to think and now I think, and I've added and I've changed my thinking because. Like, what is that shift? What informed the process of changing your mind? If you can locate that, that is the learning moment. That is the moment that had you change your mind, right? And when you're talking about reasoning with evidence, I used to think and now I think, and here's my evidence of why.
Right.
That's a really sophisticated way of thinking, right? And it is something that is accessible to some of our youngest learners, even in our pre-K-3 program, all the way up to our graduating seniors is an important part of life, is to say, hey, this is what I used to think, and now I've learned more information, and here's what I think now and why. some really great ways of uncovering and defining some of the learning moments in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love teaching fallacies. When I first started doing it, I would just teach them what the fallacies were. Now, these days, I like to pretend to be making a claim at first, easily see through claims that someone could, and I'll say, like, did you know that, blah, blah, and I'll, you know, even if it's not to do with the text, I'll start off a class and like, and I'll wait for a student and be like, wait a second, that, you know, and I'll get increasingly more sophisticated, or they're hard to figure out what's wrong with what I said. And they're learning the fallacies like that in the class. And that could be applied not only to text, but they need that for real life. Because, you know, there are people actively pulling the wool over people's eyes and like using fallacies and as weaponizing fallacies to use. If you could see through fallacies, first of all, you won't be like responding to every ad you see, you know, like a myrmidon. You know, you'll understand what's happening. And of course, you'll understand the world better. So the fallacies are really important. And that constructivist way of teaching it, I'm learning and finding better and better ways to do it.
And that's building life skills?
Yes.
Through our English courses.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So as we start to wrap up, I wonder, you know, there might be teachers who are listening that would like to shift some of their pedagogical practices into more of the ways in which you were advocating for learners to build understanding and shift more from lecture-based class to discovery-based learning. What is a piece of advice that you can leave for a teacher who's going to start that shift?
I mean, just like with everything, you have to be willing to try stuff. Like if I could do a Harkness discussion in my class, anyone could do it, because I'm like the least likely guy that you would think could sit there with my mouth shut for 45 minutes while the kids have a discussion. Now in ninth grade, I'm like, this is going to be with training wheels. I might have to intervene sometimes, but I rarely do. And, you know, it's not like you're just sitting there and, oh, I don't have to do anything today. I have like the Harkness circle and I keep track of who's saying what. Other times I'll put in, you know, if you're going to have a class, I used to do Socratic seminars. The Harkness is, in a way, easier to set up because I'm giving them read. We're going to read Act 3, Scene 1, whatever it is, and we're going to have a discussion of it. You could annotate and point up any idea you want. Hopefully, you know, you're not going to do it when you first start reading Romeo and Juliet. You're going to do it once they have a basis of, you know, facts and language to speak with. I did Harkness for the first time this year. I didn't do it last year. I was too scared. I was like, I'm not going to be able to do this, but it was immediately great, you know? And I tweak it each time. You could tweak things. I thought, oh, I have to do it exactly as they're telling me to do it. But you could say, oh, everyone, in order to get full credit, you know, because they're still extrinsically motivated, you have to use the first name of someone you're talking to, and you have to read something from the text, you know, and that gives them a solid, you know, prompt. So you could adjust it as you go, but sitting there and listening to them speak, and not only Harkness, doing any sort of thing that you're not used to give kids that you know an opportunity to, you know, strut their stuff in a domain you didn't know they were talented in. I didn't know some of these kids were even understanding the text, and all of a sudden they're shining in this discussion. It was really edifying to me watching.
So thank you for being on the show, Randy. If you want to learn more about Harkness discussions or Monarchs and Monsters, please reach out to Randy Kaplan. If you want to learn more about Randy Kaplan's music, please visit www.randykaplan.com. On behalf of everyone at Detroit Country Day School, thank you for listening to the Making School Matter podcast. If you enjoyed our time together, please like, share, and subscribe. For more episodes, you can find us on all the popular podcast sites. For more information on mind, brain, and education, or to learn more about Detroit Country Day School, please visit dcds.edu. Until next time, I'm your host, Mike Medvinsky, and I encourage you to look closely, think deeply, and wonder incessantly.
Thanks, Mike.